Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. St. Louis is the home of many firsts, some of which we know about, many of which we don't, and some of which are questionable. Diane Rademacher is a local author historian who has researched famous firsts and has found dozens of them, including a great many that are likely to surprise you. Diane Rademacher is also author of Still Shining, Discovering Lost Treasure from the 1904 World's Fair. She joins me in studio. Famous firsts of St. Louis also looks at the World's Fair, Diane. So let's start there. I think we've all heard the stories about the firsts at the World's Fair, ice cream cone, iced tea, a couple of other things. Are they really famous firsts or not?
Well, I think that we say now that they were introduced to the world at the World's Fair. Food historians have figured out that those things existed prior to the World's Fair. Iced tea was around, in the late 19th century. The ice cream cone, there's actually, I believe, a patent on an ice cream cone tray from 1903. And the hot dog, seems like that pre-existed too. But those things were probably reinvented at the fair. What I'm thinking is that you needed some portable food when you were visiting those 70,000 exhibits. So, boy, you know, an ice cream cone easily carried around, a hot dog, and iced tea on those hot days. I think they were reinvented and introduced to the world in 1904.
Well, we've all heard the story about putting ice cream in a waffle, and that was supposed to have been the first ice cream cone.
Correct. That's what they say was invented at the World's Fair, that there was a vendor selling waffles and a vendor selling ice cream, and the ice cream vendor ran out of dishes, so the waffle maker came to his rescue and, you know, made it into a cone and filled it with ice cream.
Another one of those food accidents, like toasted ravioli, which
yes.
is another one of those things that
exactly.
We talk about a lot.
It seems like a lot of our food first happened by accident.
Right.
And then everybody kind of got on the bandwagon when they became popular and said, oh, we invented that.
How did you, in your research for this, separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will, with regard to things that actually did happen here and those that maybe happened here and those that are just myth?
Well, what I tried to do was go to source documents whenever possible. And I had heard that peanut butter was invented here in St. Louis, and I just couldn't document that. I actually found out about the name of the doctor who supposedly invented it. Couldn't find him in any of the city registers and actually looked at his patent application. It said he lived in Philadelphia, so that one I discarded. So I would really try and look for source material and documentation that was highly reliable.
In terms of your research, did you kind of stumble upon things that you then researched further, or did you have a list of things that you thought were firsts and then try to track down the truth about them?
Well, I scoured a lot of books, the indexes, and yeah, some things, you know, kind of amazed me, like the junior dress. I had no idea that that was a concept that originated here in St. Louis in the 1930s. There was a merchandise manager at Klein's department store, and he just thought that women's dresses would sell to younger women more readily if they were designed for these younger women. So he challenged the art department students at Washington U to come up with designs that would appeal to the co-eds at the school and, you know, young women. And that started a whole industry here in St. Louis, the junior dress size. At one point, there were 250 dress factories that were operating in St. Louis, and we had runway shows here, and the different fashion magazines from the East Coast came to look at what was being produced here in St. Louis. That was primarily in the 40s and 50s. I mean, Mademoiselle magazine, 17, Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, they all came to see what was being produced here in St. Louis. So that was one thing that really amazed me, you know, in my research. And the public library, they have some listings of things that supposedly occurred first. And so that was, one of the guides that I used. But, of course, they just had a list. They didn't have the story. So it was up to me then to delve and try and find the story behind all these firsts.
How many firsts do you have in the book?
I think I counted up. There's 159 stories, but sometimes, as I say, there's first within firsts. So those, like the Olympics that we had here in 1904, well, this was the first site in the United States for the modern-day Olympics. And then within those Olympics, there were other firsts. The tradition of awarding gold, silver, and bronze medals, that started here in St. Louis. George Pogue was the first African-American medalist. He won two medals in the 200 and 400 meter hurdles. And also the first Native American Olympian was here in St. Louis. His name was Frank Pierce, and he predated Jim Thorpe, a very popular Olympian, by 8 years.
Does it indicate if St. Louis is exceptional or unusual in the number of firsts attributed?
Well, I don't know about that. I would like to think that we are. I got the idea when I went to Boston in 2010, and we went on the duck boat ride. That's the ride that goes in the water and on the land all around town. And all around the inside, it said Boston first in this and first in that. And I thought, gee, you know, that's sort of interesting. When I got back home here, I had applied for a job, a government contract job, and needed to get my fingerprints made down at the police department. And when I was down there, something bubbled up in the back of my mind that, gee, St. Louis, I think the police department was the first to use fingerprinting. And sure enough, that was another thing that originated from the World's Fair. English had initiated a fingerprinting system, and when they came over to, when the policemen came over to guard Queen Victoria's Jubilee gifts, one of the policemen on the force, a detective, he had an additional job, and that was to demonstrate fingerprinting at one of the booths at the World's Fair, and that then replaced former systems where body measurements were used for criminal identification. And so fingerprinting kind of stems from the World's Fair, and our police department was the first to use it.
Well, that, I'm sure, is something that catches a lot of people by surprise.
Yes.
You mentioned a moment ago that there are a lot of firsts within firsts, and again, we go back to the fair because, as you've just indicated, that's just one of many things that that popped up in 1904.
Exactly.
What are some of the others?
Well, one that I especially like, Fred Wehrenberg of the Wehrenberg Theater Chain, he went to the fair, and he went to what's called Hale's Touring Car, and it was a virtual ride inside a stationary train car, but they had some moving pictures, early moving pictures of scenes of the world flying by in the front of the train car. And so he got the idea that maybe moving pictures would help his business. He had a grocery business and a saloon. And so he started a little Nickelodeon in the back of his business, thinking that people would come in, buy things, watch the movies. And then a few years later, he knew that motion pictures had a future, not just as a side to generate better business for his grocery store. And so he started the first movie theater here in St. Louis. And then he got the idea that maybe movie theaters in neighborhoods were a good thing, so started opening theaters across town. Drive-ins later on, megaplexes today, and today the Wehrenberg Theater chain, it's the oldest family-operated movie chain in the country.
I'm not quite sure I understand how he thought the movie theater, the Nickelodeon, whatever, was going to help the grocery business other than just bring people in somehow?
Exactly, bring people in, yeah. And they would buy, you know, treats to sit there and watch the movie and probably buy things to bring home, too.
Well, a very astute businessman. Get him into the store.
No, exactly.
Along these lines, I've been looking at my notes here. There are so many things that we can talk about. But while we're talking movies, the first personal appearance by a major movie star, Florence Lawrence, to promote a film that happened at the Wehrenberg Theaters in 1910. Florence, who the heck is Florence Lawrence?
Well, she was a silent movie star, and apparently in those days, movie stars didn't hold all the acclaim and esteem that they do nowadays, and there was a plot to stage her. Well, she was supposed to have been hit by a car, and supposedly she passed away, but then she reappeared here in St. Louis, and so people were so happy to see her that this kind of started, you know, the craze about movie stars and, you know, having lots of fans and people that were just thrilled when they would see you.
Of course, when you talk about any St. Louis history, firsts or not, entertainment and the entertainment world plays a huge part, as it does in your book.
Yes, yes.
Some of the highlights.
Well, movie premieres. What movie would you think would have premiered here in St. Louis? Nothing other than Meet Me in St. Louis in November 1944.
Which was not made here, as we all know.
No, it was not made here, but, you know, it was another World's Fair-inspired movie. It debuted here down at the Lowe State Theater in downtown St. Louis. And the film was based on a book by hometown author Sally Benson. And she was a writer and a journalist. And she had written some stories called the Kensington Stories, and they were in the New Yorker magazine. And then later it was put into the book Meet Me in St. Louis. And the movie became a blockbuster. At the time, it was second only in receipts to Gone with the Wind. And, of course, you know, it's been a perennial favorite. It's probably been airing, I would think, this past week because it's a nice movie for Christmas.
You know, and I think of that movie, and I think of the song, The Boy Next Door. He lived at 5135 Kensington Avenue,
yes,
which certainly exists, but that address no longer does exist, which is kind of interesting.
Right, and Sally Benson's home, it was torn down several years ago. I had a friend who actually lived on Kensington. So when the building was being demolished, we went over there and took a few bricks.
Well, they sold the bricks. They were selling bricks with a little brass plate indicating that was the address in the movie.
Right, but yeah. I got mine free.
I did not. Another area of entertainment that is most interesting most people would want to know about, I think, is the Muni Opera. And you spend some time in your book dealing with that. I didn't realize how it started, but you can tell us.
Well, I think that the momentum from the World's Fair gave, you know, civic leaders the idea that we needed a big outdoor theater venue. And in 1914, we had the pageant and mask on Art Hill. And then in 1916, they decided to have an open-air theater where I think the presentation was, it was the first Shakespeare in the Park, As You Like It. By 1918, they decided, okay, they needed a more significant venue and built the first version of the Muni Opera, and that was for the Ad Club of St. Louis, and they presented Aida. And then in 1918, the Muni incorporated. In 1919, the first presentation was given. Robin Hood, the mayor of St. Louis, Henry Keel, he was even in that presentation. And I thought it was kind of ironic. He rode a donkey as King Richard, even though he was a Republican.
Huh. You know, as you speak about the World's Fair and all the things that were spawned as a result of, if we hadn't had that World's Fair, this might be quite a different place.
Well, I think so. I mean, when I was doing the research, I mean, there were more and more connections that I kept seeing. And when I did the index, I have more entries connected to the World's Fair than anything else in the book.
We're talking with Diane Rademacher, who is the author of Famous Firsts of St. Louis. We're going to continue that conversation. If you'd like to get involved, if you have famous firsts perhaps that you're curious about or things that you've heard you think are famous firsts, let us know, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet. STL on Air is the address for that. Back with Diane Rademacher in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Diane Rademacher, author of Famous Firsts of St. Louis, in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. A St. Louis city agency will vote later today on a petition to revoke the hotel license for the New Life Evangelistic Center, which provides emergency shelter for about 300 people a night. Downtown residents and business owners began petitioning to close New Life 2 years ago, saying that the facility is a detriment to the neighborhood. St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough is speaking out about his decisions related to the grand jury that heard evidence in the Darren Wilson-Michael Brown shooting. McCullough has said he stands by the choice to present all evidence and testimony to the jury, even though some had been discredited. And the I Love Ferguson organization today gave $50,000 to the Reinvest North County Fund, which helps businesses and schools that were damaged or looted during the unrest following the shooting death of Brown in August. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Diane Rademacher. One of the things that I found most fascinating was, and who would have thought it, that the first cocktail party ever recorded, I guess, however that might have been, was right here in St. Louis. But what I found equally fascinating is what the building where that party was held, is what the building is used for today.
Yes, it's a pretty fascinating story, I think, too. Back in 1917, the woman who was living in this mansion on Lindell at Taylor Boulevard, she decided to have a cocktail party to precede her Sunday noon 1 p.m. luncheon. The cocktail party was to commence at noon. And so she hired a bartender, and he mixed cocktails for the 50 guests that were invited. And they served things like gin fizzes and highballs and Manhattans and martinis and some more exotic concoctions. And then following the cocktail party, she had a luncheon. Well, the society writers, they caught wind of this, and so they wrote about the invention of the cocktail party by Clara Walsh at her mansion on Lindell at Taylor, and that was 1917. And I actually looked in some old newspapers. I found an article in the Tacoma Times, and I believe there was an article in a newspaper from Minnesota that talked about this cocktail party as a new social innovation. Well, by 1924, the house was sold, and it is now the residence of the Archbishop of St. Louis. So the article in my book, I have the first cocktail party at Archbishop's residence in a manner of speaking.
Who knew? Who knew, as they say. You know, what surprises me about that is the fact that the cocktail party wasn't invented until 1917.
Right. Well, you know, I had read elsewhere that in England, but that wasn't until the 1920s, you know, where the first cocktail party was. And so it looks like all the sources are pointing to St. Louis as the originator of the cocktail party.
Well, something else that we can chalk up to a St. Louis first. You know, in preparation for this program, we asked many of our listeners to kind of tell us what their first memories was, to kind of hook up to the idea of your book. And we've received a few of them, and we're encouraging folks to write to our website. Email our website and contact us somehow to tell us about those first memories. I'll give you a couple of them because they're kind of interesting.
Okay.
Kim writes, "My first memory of St. Louis in the broader sense beyond home and family is of the Christmas display windows downtown back in the late 50s and early 60s. Now, those display windows were not invented here in St. Louis, that's for sure.
I don't believe those were. I used to enjoy going to see those, too. And actually, a friend of mine has written about the display windows at Famous Bar in her new book, Famous Bar, Edna Campos Gravenhurst.
And she was a guest on our program just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh,
there are a lot of books coming out at this time of year in conjunction with the 250th anniversary. And also, it is Christmas time, I'm told, and it's a great time. These are coffee table type books, great gift ideas.
Yes, indeed.
Another first memory I'll mention here from Alan Campbell of O'Fallon, Illinois. My first memory of St. Louis would be driving to Scott Air Force Base in January of 1990 and seeing the Arch for the first time.
Oh.
Now, the Arch is certainly a first. There are no other arches that I'm aware of like this.
Right. It does qualify in my book as a first because it's the tallest man-made monument in the nation.
Nancy Meyer writes, "My first memory, getting lost at the zoo when I was about 4. Does the St. Louis Zoo make its way into your book?
Yes, it does, because it was the first tax-supported zoo in the world, which is quite significant. And it was actually voted as such back in 1916. Yeah. The first related to the zoo was among the first zoos to use natural habitat to replace cages. And I think it's intriguing in the bear pits, the rock designs were based on what is on the bluffs down near Herculaneum, Missouri. They took molds of those bluffs, and also the elephant rocks, I think, in the Antelope area. Just recently, the endangered Ozark hellbender, which is a type of salamander, yeah. There had been efforts to, you know, repropagate those particular salamanders. So that was a first, and just lots of other things associated with, you know, animal life in the zoo.
And then, of course, Marlon Perkins came later, and he really put it on the map, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes, indeed.
You know,
yes.
Yeah, I'm struck during the conversation, which is relatively short, our conversation so far, is how important the first 20 years of the 20th century were for St. Louis.
Yes, I think that was really, you know, a time when, you know, people just really had a lot of energy. St. Louis was the fourth city in the United States where we were growing. We had all sorts of industry. We had, you know, the shoes and the beer. We had two ball teams. And it was just, you know, it seemed like just a, a really vibrant time. When you see old photographs of all the activity on the streets, it just must have been an exciting
time. So what happened? Have you figured it out?
Yeah. I guess it's because our industry has declined.
Yeah. It's kind of a sad story in a way. We were on such a meteoric trajectory at one time, and then we sort of just stopped while Chicago took over.
Yes.
Part of the story. Anyway, just back to these first memories. I want folks to know, if you'd like to get in on that part of the discussion and tell us your first memory, send us a tweet at STL on Air or email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. And you can sign up for our weekly newsletter where we first pose the question at stlpublicradio.org. So if you want to tell us about your first memory, we'll take that and probably put it on our website. Let me go to the phones. Bill is joining us from Spanish Lake, and we'll hear what his question is. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
There was another first. I don't know if it's in the book, but the movie, Parent Trap, featuring Haley Mills, was premiered at the Fox Theater in the late 60s. And I think it was chosen, St. Louis was chosen, because Rosalind Russell is a St. Louis native, and she was, you know, had a predominant part in that movie. And I told your phone screener that this was the late 60s, and I was a teenager in high school, and Haley Mills was hot. So, so anyway, yeah, and the reason I remember this, by the way, is that I went to CBC, I was in the band, and the band was invited to play outside the theater for the dedication, or for the opening of the movie. So it was a lot of fun.
Must have been. Bill, thank you so much for the call.
You bet.
Does that mean anything to you, the Parent Trap?
Well, I haven't heard that, but that's interesting. I will add that to my list, because as I talk about the book different places and people tell me, you know, some additional firsts, or I read more, I've started a list of additional firsts about St. Louis. So thank you.
So a sequel is in the offing.
Well,
perhaps.
I don't know about that.
One thing he said that surprised me is I never had heard that Rosalind Russell was from St. Louis. We have a lot of credits in terms of well-known actors and actresses who come from here, but I'd never heard Rosalind Russell.
Yes, I don't know if I've heard that either. Yeah. Although I know that The Parent Trap was one of my favorite films. I saw that as a young teenager, and that was a cool film to see.
Did you think Haley Mills was hot?
No, I did not.
Let's change the subject before I get into trouble. Beer. Of course, when we think of St. Louis, we have to think about beer. And one of the things I noted in your book was that it's not all about Anheuser-Busch, that the Lemp folks also had a notable first.
Right. Well, the Lemps apparently were the first to use refrigerated cars to transport beer across the country, so it didn't need just to be a local brew anymore. You could have Lemp beer just about anywhere that a train would travel. Hmm. And I know lager beer, some think that was started here in St. Louis, and I'm sure that, you know, both the Lemp and the Anheuser-Busch breweries have a part in that story.
Well, obviously, Anheuser-Busch went on to just overtake the Lemp folks pretty much. What about Anheuser-Busch first? So they must have some.
Well, I know Budweiser was the first national brand beer, and Michelob was the first specialty brand. I'm sure there's many others. They had down at their museum, they have a whole display about the products and the many different firsts.
Was there anything that you discovered in your research that just blew you away, that you were totally surprised by learning?
Well, the one thing that I thought was really super significant was the fact that in the 1950s, during the Cold War, concerned citizens here in St. Louis were really concerned about the fallout coming from the nuclear testings. And so they decided to do something about it. There was a chemical component that was a byproduct of the nuclear testing, strontium-90, and that was being deposited, over the Midwest, and it was getting into the food system. And people were concerned that strontium-90, if it was ingested to a significant degree, was cancer-causing. And so since it accumulated in the bones and in the teeth, the baby tooth study was started, and over 300,000 baby teeth were analyzed, And there was a correlation between the testing and the amount of strontium 90 in the teeth. And the report was given to President John Kennedy, and he used that in part to negotiate the partial nuclear test ban treaty of 1963. So I think that it's really significant that, you know, St. Louisans, especially children, played a big part in getting that test ban treaty negotiated.
That's fascinating. Of course, St. Louis played another role during World War II with regard to research for the Manhattan Project, and we're still living with some of the residue, residue of that project.
Right.
Sports. We can't talk much about St. Louis without talking about the baseball team and others. Do we have any firsts associated with sports?
Well, the one that I like is the fact that Fernando Tatis, I believe that was in 1999, he's the only player in baseball history to ever hit two Grand Slam home runs in the same inning, and it was against the same pitcher, Chan Ho Park. And it just seems amazing that he would hit two, and they hadn't even taken the opposing pitcher out when he came up for that second at-bat.
I remember that well.
Yes.
Also, the first night game in Major League history, is that correct, was played here?
I believe it was the first night opening day game at night that happened here in St. Louis.
Cardinals versus?
I don't remember that team.
Pittsburgh Pirates.
The Pittsburgh Pirates.
Any other sports rec? Because you've got it broken down into sports, architecture, culture, entertainment, medicine, education, and food. You really have to kind of compartmentalize some of these things. But other famous sports firsts that come to mind?
Oh, there's lots of famous. Let's see. The Rams were the only team to win the national championship in three different cities. They were in Cleveland, they were in Los Angeles, and here in St. Louis, and let's hope they stay.
We'll see.
Let's see. High Lie, which is sort of interesting. High Lie made its national debut here in St. Louis in 1904. It was not an Olympic sport, or it was not really in conjunction with the World's Fair, but apparently different individuals who thought that maybe they could use the World's Fair and the crowds that would come to their benefit, you know, started other types of concessions. And so there was a High Lie court. It was on Devolver, just down the street from the History Museum. It seated 6,000 people, and High Lie was played there for 2 months. And it was the national debut of the sport in the United States.
And then it moved to Florida.
Yes, indeed.
That's a fascinating tidbit of information. Any others before we move on to some of the other categories?
Let's see. Well, in golf, George Herbert Walker started the Walker Cup, and he's probably more well-known for his two presidential grandson, mm-hmm. George Herbert Walker Bush and George Walker Bush. And the Davis Cup started by Dwight Davis. Yes, here in St. Louis. He started the competition and also donated the money to pay for the original cup.
Right. Another, I think many people are familiar with the fact that the New York famous Radio City Music Hall Rockettes actually could have been called the St. Louis Rockettes, and were at one time.
Well, they were the Missouri Rockets.
Missouri Rockets or Rockettes?
Rockets. Yes. I read that the choreographer, he preferred the name Rocket because apparently that was, you know, kind of a trendy name at the time. But his name was Russell Markert. He was a dancer and a choreographer, and he had seen a dance line in the Ziegfeld Follies in 1922, and so he decided he was going to start his own high-kicking dance troupe, 1925, at the Grand Central Theater down right here in Grand Center. And a couple months later, they moved down the street to the Missouri Theater and got dubbed with the name Missouri Rockets. Mm-hmm. And then he subsequently took the troupe on tour to New York City, and a theatrical promoter, Roxy Rothafel, saw the dancers and decided they needed to perform at his theaters. And he enlarged the troupe to 32, dubbed them the Roxyettes. And then in 1934, they became the Radio City Rockettes, and they actually performed at the first opening night performance at Radio City.
Yeah. I went to a high school with a girl who tried out for the Rockettes, and she was disqualified because she was an eighth of an inch too tall. They all had to be exactly the same Just a little factoid.
Yeah, I have a great picture in the book of the 1925 rockets, looking at Mr. Merkert doing a split in front of them.
A lot of nice pictures in your book. We should should talk for a moment about the format of it, because it's as I indicated, it is a nice coffee table book, a nice holiday gift, and lots of photographs and other graphics.
Yes, and Kathy Wood, she was the book designer, so I have to give her a lot of credit for the lovely layout.
She did a great job. Let's take another call. We'll bring in Art calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Art.
Yeah, thanks, Don. You know, there was a lot of competition between Solden and Ben Boo at high school, but we had a coach, Eugene Seitz. He gave us 17 straight consecutive years of gymnastic championships in the city of St. Louis. Now, the Solden had a good football team. They came over to our track and field area to go ahead and practice. But the thing of it is our swimming team, we all swam at the YMHA over there at Enright and Union. Thanks for taking the call.
Okay, Art, thanks for calling. Anything to add to or comment upon Art's comment?
I don't believe so.
You know, I think we have folks out there who remember some things that some of us have forgotten if we ever knew them in the first place. I have to take another break. We'll do that now. Come back, continue our conversation with Diane Rademacher, author of Famous Firsts in St. Louis. That's what we're talking about. If you'd like to get into the conversation, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Or send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with Diane Rademacher, author of Famous Firsts of St. Louis, and I think the title is self-explanatory. 'Tis the season, and another thing that I found most interesting in your book was that the iconic image that we have of Santa Claus these days actually has a St. Louis connection. What is that?
Well, back in the 1930s, Coca-Cola wanted to boost sales of Coke during the winter as well as the summer, where it was already popular. And so they had already made some sort of connection with Coke and Santa, apparently kind of a serious-looking Santa. And actually, one other, I think, ad was a Santa that looked more like a man just dressed in a Santa suit. So they were looking for something that was a little bit more jazzy. So they contracted with the Darcy Advertising Company here in St. Louis, and Darcy worked with an illustrator, Hayden Sunblum, and he created a Santa Claus that was more of a character rather than just a man dressed in a suit. And he used the description from Clement Moore's The Night Before Christmas to create the Santa figure, someone that was jovial, big beard, jolly, someone that was very inviting. We all know what this Santa Claus looks like now. He's the iconic Santa that we're all familiar with, and he essentially replaced the folkloric Santa Clauses, primarily from Germany, that were often thin and sometimes very serious and stern-looking. And I was in Germany a few years ago and was talking to some people, and they were talking about how the United States has influence some of their holidays nowadays, including how Halloween traditions now are celebrated over in Germany when they never were. And one young lady said, and even Santa Claus, she said, he's now that Coca-Cola man.
I lived in Germany for a while, and the Santa Claus that I was familiar with there was far different from that jolly old elf that Clement Moore gave us. Yes. We'll have more on Clement Moore and The Night Before Christmas, by the way, tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air. Let's try another call. Jerry's going to tie in with something we talked about a moment ago. He's in O'Fallon. Go ahead, Jerry. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I very much remember being part of the Tooth Fairy program where they collected our baby teeth, even though it was nationwide. I grew up right here in the St. Louis area. And I also, I don't know if it's related, but actually I had two different types of cancer, and both times I was asked by the physicians if I'd had any exposure to heavy metal pollutants or radioactive material. And, of course, you know, now in retrospect we know that the material, I believe, for both of the original atomic bombs was all processed not too far from where I am today. And, you know, now we're just discovering that there's radium in Princeton, and a lot of that stuff was dumped at Lambert Field, including, I believe, an entire truck that was radioactive, long before they really had much of an understanding of, you know, of what the half-life or what the true hazards of that material would be. So I guess that's kind of a first for our area, but really not one we, I guess, we'd be basically proud of.
Jerry, thanks. Okay. Thanks for the call. I think that subterranean fire or smoldering actually plugs into that part of the story as well, because there's some nuclear residue of some sort there that it could be threatening. Let's go to Hillsborough and bring in Bob. Bob, thanks for being with us. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. You guys may not remember this, but back in the 1940s, the St. Louis Browns had a center fielder named Pete Gray, and he only had one arm. He was an extraordinary athlete. A fly ball, he would catch it with the glove on the one arm. He'd flip the ball up in the air, drop the glove, catch the ball, and then throw it into the infield. It was extraordinary to watch. So I didn't know if you guys were aware of that or not. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call.
That's an interesting first. And, in fact, I do have one related to the Browns in my book, the shortest baseball player ever to play in a game, Eddie Goodell. It was kind of a promotional gimmick at a game. And Eddie appeared, walked on four pitches, went down the first base, received his $100 for his appearance, and went on to, you know, really have some acclaim after, you know, his appearance, because he was the shortest player ever to play in a baseball game.
He was, I think, identified as a midget at the time, if that was the proper terminology. But that was Bill Veeck, the owner of the team that brought him in to do that.
Yes, he
and
did.
A little piece of trivia for you is the fact that the uniform he was wearing was the uniform of Bill DeWitt Sr., who now owns the Cardinals, who was the bat boy for that team, and it was the only uniform that would fit Eddie Goodell.
Yes, indeed. It was a crazy day.
a lot of fun stuff to look back on. Let's try another call. Eric in St. Peter's. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, the first that I recall about is about the St. Louis Cardinals. This is back in the mid-90s. They had, I think they were playing the Phillies, but they had won three straight in the World Series. And they got down to the final out, even the final strike, and could not get the batter out. In fact, they lost that game and the next three. I think that was the first time that had ever happened to any team here in St. Louis, perhaps any team at all. I'm just not sure about the nationwide on it, but I think it was the first time it had happened here in St. Louis.
Thanks very much for pointing that out. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. A couple of other baseball things that are in your book, and I know you don't want to get bogged down in sports. There are so many of the things to talk about, but the first woman on a Major League Baseball team has the St. Louis connection.
Yes, Helene Robeson Britton. She actually inherited the team from her father and her uncle after they both passed away. And the fraternity of baseball owners probably didn't think that she was going to take the reins, but she showed them otherwise. She had grown up in a baseball family, and she was quite a fan. They said even when she was a small girl, she would keep score at the baseball games because her father and uncle had been affiliated with the Cleveland team prior to the Cardinals. So she had the team from 1911 to 1918, and actually the Cardinals did a little better during her ownership than they had done since 1892. I was looking at some of the records, and you know, they fared better. They weren't a great team, but they did a little better during her tenure. And she served as the president of the team after her husband, who had held that position, resigned. And she was the first woman to address the National League owners with a speech. So, you know, when we think about Marge Schott,
I was just going to mention that.
As a baseball owner, well, we beat Marge Schott and the Cincinnati Reds by many years with our own Helene Robeson Britton.
I'm sure she was a much different type of person than Marge Schott was, too, who had some, there were some negatives, I think,
yes,
associated with Ms. Schott. By the way, we have an email here from Patricia Cassens, who writes, Rosalind Russell is from Waterbury, Connecticut, not in The Parent Trap. Maureen O'Hara was, so we've clarified that. I didn't think that that she was from here. What about education? I know you spend some time in the book talking about education firsts here, and some of them are certainly noteworthy.
Well, Susan Blow started the kindergarten movement here in St. Louis. She was inspired when she went to Germany and saw how the kindergartens were being used there to give children sort of a hands-on experience, learning with, what did she call them, gifts. They were educational tools that the children could manipulate to learn fractions and to learn their, vocabulary. And actually, they just learned how to be good little citizens in the classes, too. And the kindergarten movement then, of course, it spread, throughout the nation. And then we have an architect here, William Itner?
Itner, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he was an architect of many school buildings here in St. Louis, 50, in fact, 45 elementary schools and 5 high schools. And he thought that the schools shouldn't just be a little box. So he elongated the designs and often put the kindergarten right in the middle of the school, right in the heart, he called it. So, the kindergarten movement not only had its influence with, education, but also in the design of the school buildings.
He also did something else, as I remember correctly, and that was he structured the buildings and the windows in such a way that there would always be a draft, so that in the hot St. Louis weather, there would always be a cooling effect in these schools, and that was quite an innovation in its time as well.
Right. He wanted a lot of light in the buildings, right. And he made the buildings beautiful. If you drive around the city, there's actually a list online where you can see all the Itner buildings listed. Some of them have beautiful terracotta and mosaics. They have art glass windows. They're really quite beautiful buildings because he wanted the educational experience to be a very positive one. And he also designed right near where we are here the Continental Building, and and that has an interesting first because the Continental Building had the Grand National Bank at its lower level and had the first drive-up window in the back of the bank. It was alongside the alley, and there was a drive-up window. You pressed a button, and the shade came up, and a teller would take care of a transaction right there from your car.
Something we take for granted now. I guess all of us do our banking that way pretty much these days. I want to go back to the phones, but one other thing I did want to point out, because I found it surprising, other people might as well, and that is that the with regard to the Catholic Church here in St. Louis, the first Mass, not in Latin, but in English,
yes,
that
was
right here.
In 1964, the first Mass that was authorized to be celebrated in English took place. It was a convention downtown at Kiel Auditorium, so there were a lot of people in attendance. And I thought that was, very significant that happened right here in St. Louis, not in New York City or, another large city in the U.S.
That's what surprised me about it. Let's go back to the phones. Richard in St. Louis, you're on the air with Diane.
Thank you, Don. And Diane, your book is very interesting, but I had a question if you also came across the action of Mr. Bush of the brewery in 1906 when he brought back from Germany the patent for diesel engines from the diesel company, and then, or from Rudolf Diesel, and then formed the first diesel manufacturing plant in St. Louis, because it was a pretty visionary thing to have done and a very early innovation for diesel engines.
Well, no, I didn't know that, but that's another interesting fact.
So you do have a sequel in the making here.
Yes, I'm going to have to add a couple entries to my list when I get home.
Take another call. Dennis joins us from Overland. Dennis, go ahead.
Don, long-time listener, 58th time caller.
I think it's 62.
Okay.
Who's counting?
Okay, who's counting? Well, I wanted to remind everybody that Beaumont High School, up until a few years ago, I think a California high school team took the lead. But you had the record for the most pro major league ball players. They had quite a record there for many years. And then in the music, I just wanted to point out Miles Davis was right here on the edge of St. Louis. And then, of course, Ike Turner came up, and Tina had her start here. And then, of course, Chuck Berry and Johnny Johnson. So we had a lot of, I would say, firsts. So
we certainly did. Sure. Dennis, thank you. Yeah, and you certainly note that in the book, a number of fine musicians, obviously.
Right. Also, Scott Joplin. Here's another World's Fair connection. Mm-hmm. Scott Joplin came to St. Louis in the early part of the 20th century and lived here for a short time. And he was inspired by the Cascades, the waterfall beneath the Festival Hall at the World's Fair. And he wrote that beautiful rag, The Cascades, from that inspiration.
Yeah. And Miles Davis, of course, and Ike and Tina Turner, as was mentioned, just for starters.
And Chuck Berry, he was the first inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. I do talk about him in my book. And also all the other notables from Sumner High School. I mean, that list is impressive.
Absolutely. Products. Many people will not be surprised by some of the products that were launched here, but we all heard about them, I think. Tell us what some of them are.
Well, I guess one that I kind of is near and dear to my heart are Buster Brown shoes. Actually, that has another World's Fair connection because Buster Brown and Tige, that was a cartoon, and then the owner of the Brown Shoe Company, he got the rights to use the cartoon characters to promote his shoes, so he actually hired an actor and a dog, and they first appeared at the World's Fair to advertise the shoes. And then went around the country. And by 1958, Brown Shoes, and my dad worked at Brown Shoe Company, Brown Shoes, the children's shoe division, was the largest in the world.
I'm Buster Brown. I live in a shoe. That's my dog, Tig. He lives there, too.
You bet.
I remember that growing up. And I grew up on the East Coast. I didn't know that. Listening to that was making a St. Louis connection. What else comes to mind? Did you blow any myths in your research, things that you thought were definitely going to be part of a St. Louis first but turned out not to be?
Oh, I guess I did go down some pathways, like I said, about peanut butter. Yeah. One that I'd like to mention, though, women's hair care in the African-American community, Annie Malone. She became the first African-American millionaire in the country. And she was here in St. Louis. She came here right before the World's Fair, hoping to increase, you know, her market. And she sold these hair care products. She had a huge sales force, women that went door to door to sell the products. And she started a college here in St. Louis, and I believe 30 colleges were started nationwide to sell her products and to train her staff. She really did a lot for the community, especially for orphans. And today we have the Annie Malone Children's Home that's named in her honor.
And the Annie Malone Parade.
And the Annie Malone Parade, correct. Well,
very quickly, medicine. Medicine played a big role in our city's history.
Yes, the first lung excision operation happened here in St. Louis.
The what operation?
Lung removal.
Lung removal, okay.
Lung removal, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Also, the first real connection between smoking and lung cancer, a study was done at Washington University that showed that linkage. Down at Cardinal Glennon Hospital, there's fetal surgeries that have occurred that have been, you know, the first ever. You know, we do have a wonderful legacy of, you know, medical innovations here in St. Louis.
What was the most fun for you, Diane, and putting all this together?
Well, I think I have a friend. We went and did pizza and toasted ravioli research.
How often?
Well, we did that a few times. Taking pictures and, you know, kind of comparing and, you know, St. Louis-style pizza and toasted ravioli over on the hill. We had to try the different ones that claimed to be the place where toasted ravioli originated.
And Provel cheese also is featured prominently.
Yes.
What's that all about?
Well, it's a tri-bond. I think it's cheddar, provolone, and Swiss. And the idea way back when was to come up with a cheese that wasn't stringy. So when you put it on a pizza, you can just bite right through it. And so it was a creation that was really originated here in St. Louis. There's a couple different stories that go with that, but it's kind of unique to our area.
Okay. Well, Diane Rademacher, I want to thank you so much for being with us and telling us about your book, Famous Firsts of St. Louis. Again, there's still time for folks to go out and get that in time for Christmas.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with
us. Appreciate it.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk feature stories. We'll talk Christmas Eve kinds of things, if you will, poems and music, especially for Christmas Eve. And as we say goodbye, we want to say goodbye with some music that is very relevant to this time of year. From the movie we mentioned a few moments ago, Meet Me in St. Louis. Listen to Judy Garland. We'll see you all tomorrow, everyone. Thank you.